The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
As vaccination rates hit a wall, the Delta variant is driving a rise in new coronavirus infections and hospitalizations across the country. Experts believe the new strain of the virus is more contagious and blame the Delta variant for a rise in infections among unvaccinated populations in the U.S. and around the globe. Vaccines have continued to prove effective in protecting against the variant.
So the vaccines work. I mean, that's the, you know, the good news, bad news. The bad news is that we have a very nasty variant, and the good news is that we have a vaccine that works against it.
Only about half of U.S. adults have taken the shot, however.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, good afternoon and welcome. It is great to be here with you today. Thank you for joining me. I'm glad you're with me. I'm here for you to give you a look at life, and we've got a lot to get in today. COVID, we'll talk about it. There is so much news regarding COVID. I keep wondering every week when I'm going to be talking about it for the last time, but boy, you heard about the mask mandate returning to Los Angeles County. We'll get into that a little bit later. Pfizer saying you might need a booster shot. The FDA now is warning that the J&J COVID-19 vaccine could raise risks of a rare neurological diseases. And then there's some bizarre stories out there, too. I want to bring you up to speed on whether or not coffee, of all things, Java, if that is linked to lower risk of COVID-19. I don't know. We'll see. You know, like I said, I lived in a house with two people who had COVID. And for some reason, I remained implacable. I do like coffee, so. But we'll talk about it. We'll talk about what's happening with COVID in the not-too-distant future and what you might see. There's even evidence that flu shots could protect against some severe COVID-19 effects. But we'll get you up to speed on that a little bit later today. Hey, something that we need to talk about here, and something I'll be monitoring. I won't dive into it in great detail today, but I will go ahead and look at this at some point in the future. Big tech, right? And I have my eyes on them. I've been monitoring what they've done in elections, how they are censoring pro-life organizations, how they are filtering information that you have a right to, right? Well, you might have a problem with them. They're a private company, right? Well, now it seems that the White House is getting involved. Censorship by big tech has been a huge, huge conversation over the last couple of years, and a lot of it has been defended by the idea, look, these companies are private. They're privately owned, and I get that, believe me, and I'm an advocate of that. So, as a result, they're not subject to the First Amendment. But when you look at the size of an organization like Facebook, or you take a look at Twitter, I mean, they are larger than most nations on the planet. Things might be changing. The White House spokeswoman, Jen Psaki, yesterday was at a press conference, and this is what she had to say about what the White House was doing. Check this out.
Well, first, we are in regular touch with these social media platforms, and those engagements typically happen through members of our senior staff, but also members of our COVID-19 team. Given, as Dr. Murthy conveyed, this is a big issue of misinformation, specifically on the pandemic. In terms of actions, Alex, that we have taken, or we're working to take, I should say, from the federal government, we've increased disinformation research and tracking within the Surgeon General's office. We're flagging problematic posts for Facebook that spread disinformation. We're working with doctors and medical professionals to connect to connected medical experts who are popular with their audiences with accurate information and boost trusted content. So we're helping get trusted content out there. We also created the COVID Community Corps to get factual information into the hands of local messengers. And we're also investing, as you all have seen, in the president's, the vice president's, and Dr. Fauci. Time in meeting with influencers who also have large reaches to a lot of these target audiences who can spread and share accurate information.
All right. So all sounds good, doesn't it? When they deliver, you know, their answers. But let me just quote something she said again, because I think it's important that we at least be aware of this, right? She says, quote, "We are flagging problematic posts for Facebook that spread disinformation." Okay. Well, what is disinformation? Who is the filter of that? You know, you don't like, let's say, what's being reported about, I don't know, vaccines or the side effects or what somebody may have concerns about. She says there are about 12 people that are producing 65% of anti-vaccine misinformation on social media platforms. All of them remain active on Facebook, despite some of them have been banned on other platforms, including ones that Facebook owns. And that, of course, means that you've got, you want to zoom out so you can understand what's happening here. It means the government, right? It's now going into a private enterprise, a private business. The government is coercing private industry to censor what people say. Now, I may not like what these 12 people or the misinformation that's out there. You may not like it either. But you know what? I would rather have the right to read it and make my own informed decision as to whether or not I'm going to believe it or not. We should be very cautious when the federal government begins to censor the information that you have access to. And when they're coercing a major, major corporation like Facebook, coercing a private industry to censor what people are saying, look, just from a First Amendment perspective, there's a lot of implications. And I'll tell you what, we'll dive into this in the future. I don't have time to unpack it. It's a big story. I wanted to, but I got a lot to share with you today. That's a big, big story. Keep your eye on that, okay? Yeah, I think about Cuba. Yeah, I take a look at some of these communist countries, China, others, North Korea. You don't get a free internet, right? They decide what you can see and what you can't see. They're propaganda tools. And not that we're heading in that direction here, but when you've got the White House censoring what they don't like, I just think we should hit the brakes a little bit. Slow down. Pause, right? There's a House committee, too, that just passed a spending bill that does not have the Hyde Amendment in it. Now, remember, that amendment, which has been part of spending packages ever since 1976, and if you're not familiar with the Hyde Amendment, it's all about it. Bottom line is it forbids your tax dollars from being spent on most abortions. And I say, bravo, I don't want a penny of mine. I don't want a single cent. I don't want a centilla spent on abortion. Absolutely not. So that amendment, as I said, you know, it's been a part of this for a long time, ever since 76, and it forbids your tax dollars from being spent on the culture of death, on killing children. It received bipartisan votes for many, many years, right? But we're in a different time. Every year, whether it was, you know, Democrat or a Republican in office, you had these bipartisan votes up until this year. An amendment to the bill to add the Hyde Amendment failed. But that's not all. According to the Catholic News Agency, this is where I saw that, and you can check out the story, the bill also requires family planning clinics receiving, you know, Title 10 funding to provide non-directive abortion counseling and to make referrals for abortions upon request. And it also would reverse conscience protections for healthcare workers by excluding the Weldon Amendment. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on here. You may not follow all this too closely, but bottom line for me is I just don't want my tax dollars paying for abortion. Now, I know you feel the same way. You have to. I also don't want healthcare workers, and you may have a spouse, a child. You may be in the industry yourself. Do you want your conscience rights violated? I don't think healthcare workers should go to work and have their consciences violated. I just don't buy that. So if you want to, you can go to the show's Facebook page for a link to Catholic Vote. You'll find where you can take action. Let your member of Congress know that you don't want your hard-earned tax dollars going to fund evil abortion. And if you missed my conversation yesterday, it was an hour one. I had a great conversation with Congressman Jeff Fortenberry, and he unpacked a lot of what was going on. Again, that's relevantradio.com. Just go to the archives and look at the shows that we have archived. There's some great conversations, okay, and share them with others. One other thing here, teachers unions. There's been a lot of criticism from teachers unions about people opposing critical race theory and that being taught in schools. And look, I think we've talked about this for months now, right? We've broken it down. We looked at the real threat to it. We looked at what true history was. We looked at the agenda behind it. We looked at the money going into it. These union leaders are claiming that public education is really the best education there is. Do you buy that? Is public education the best education there is? Let me share with you a stat, all right? Wait till you hear these numbers. And I shouldn't even chuckle about it because they're just so ridiculous. It's ridiculous to think that that type of education is best. And I'll tell you why. Listen to this. Here are the stats. The stats from Baltimore, they really beg to differ. There was a reporter at Fox 45 in Charm City there. He looked up the GPA for 20,500 high school students. That's not a small group, right? What's the GPA for almost 21,000 high school students in his district? Incredibly, 41% of those. Now, this is disgraceful. It is a shame. And there's a real problem here. Something is broken and needs to be fixed. 41% of those GPAs were below 1.0. You know, 4.0 is that A average. That's up there. You want to be a 4.0. 3.0 is good. You know, 2.5 is average. What, it's below 2 out of 5. 41% are below 1.0. That's less than a D average. Almost half less than a D average. So I sit back here and I'm thinking, well, why? Is it because Baltimore's impoverished? Is it a lack of money? Hotairs.com, Jack Sexton, I was reading him. He pointed out that Baltimore has the third highest spending rate for a major metropolitan area in the country. So it's not money. Now, whether anyone's going to account for the massive failure unit, I have no idea. I'm curious as to what is causing it. Fox 8 in Baltimore will give you an exclusive look at the way the pandemic lockdown has played a role. And I think this has something to do with it, but I don't think entirely. It talks a little bit about how students' learning abilities have been affected.
This is just further perpetuating the cycle of poverty, blight, despair.
This chart was assembled by Baltimore City Schools and obtained by Project Baltimore. It shows the average GPA for every high school grade in the city, freshman through senior. In the first three quarters of this past school year, according to the chart, 41% of all Baltimore City high school students earned below a 1.0 grade point average. In other words, nearly half of the roughly 20,600 public high school students in Baltimore earned less than a D average.
It's heartbreaking. If almost half of our kids are failing, what options do they have after high school? This is really disheartening. It's sad to see this, man.
On the other end of this chart, 21% of city high school students earned a GPA of 3.0 or better, a B average, about half as many who earned below a D. We can also see the district lost more than 700 high school students during the first three quarters of this year.
In January, City School CEO Dr. Sonia Santelises first sounded the alarm, saying the course failure rate for students had nearly doubled during the COVID shutdowns. A few months later, in May, North Avenue announced students would not be held back for failing classes. This most recent GPA data could show us why North Avenue made that decision.
During the second quarter of the 2019-2020 school year, just before COVID hit, 24% of high school students had a GPA below one. Now it's 41%.
It's tragic. Like, I hope they get it right. Those are American citizens. They are great students. And believe me, they deserve a right to quality education, but less than a 1.0, and then they get shuffled from grade to grade. We got to fix it soon. Hey, there's a war going on right now in South Asia, and I want to bring you up to speed on this. It's been largely ignored by the mainstream media of late, and as always, I try to give you a look at international news. So often here in America, and I say this a lot, it's not an indictment on our media. I mean, we want to talk COVID, we want to talk economy, we want to talk politics, right? I mean, that's what you get in your mainstream evening news. They'll give you a splash of international news. But this is a pretty big story. And I've been talking about the Uyghurs. There's an event unfolding right now in Southeast Asia. Back in February, it was big news when the leader of Myanmar was deposed. Myanmar is also Burma, as it used to be known. It was deposed by a military-led coup, and the leader was Aung San Suu Kyi. And Suu Kyi gained international prominence because she won the Nobel Peace Prize after being peacefully elected after she had been jailed for many years by another military government. But despite the Peace Prize, her treatment of the people, which has been called a genocide, brought her into just absolute disrepute in the international community. And she was, as I said, deposed by a military, you know, junta, and the military's been ruling ever since. But usually military rule brings order to a disordered country, but that's not been the case in Myanmar. Foreign companies are leaving because there's absolute chaos there. And unfortunately, and here's a reality that's happening, Christians, persecution of Christians in what is mostly a Buddhist country, it's beginning to ratchet up. It's getting more intense. And political factions of all kinds have now developed. And there's a disordered and very ineffective rebellion against the military rulers. So civilians are fleeing to the countryside. And impromptu, you know, military camps are being established. The opposition groups, according to several news sources, have no funding. So as a result, they have no arms, very little training. It's a troubled situation. I've invited to the program today a man named Jack Snow. That's actually a pseudonym. He's an American living and working in Rangoon, also known as Yangon, which used to be the capital city. And he works with street kids there, trying to give them an education in the midst of this chaos. I have to give him a pseudonym just for his own safety. If who he is came to light, his own safety, that of his family, his freedom could be in trouble. And I'm grateful for his courage and joining me today. Jack, thank you for being here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So I know this is probably out of the purview of a lot of Americans. They're not following this story at all. Bring us up to speed on what's unfolding. What's the political orientation of the military? Is this a communist group? And what's it like on the streets right now? I mean, paint a picture for us of what's happening and why this situation is so critical.
Sure. They're communists, and this is the third attempt at taking over the country. They were successful the previous two times. People, unfortunately, were lulled into a false sense of security in 2010 when they gave up power to Aung San Suu Kyi and the civilian government. The first time was right after the Raj, the British Raj fell. And second time was in 1988. 1988, and the third time was now. Yeah. It's perfect bedlam and chaos here. So food in the stores or in the street markets, things are really getting desperate here. The government has the military has closed all oxygen canister replenishers.
Yep.
And some people believe that, oddly, the COVID has broken out exponentially here.
Jack, I hate to interrupt you, but I'm having tremendous difficulty with our connection. Is there a possibility you can move to another location where we might have a better connection? I know connection can be hard there. Thank you. And that'll be better. We only have a few minutes today. I know that Burma is primarily Buddhist. Has the church made any inroads there? What's going on with Christians? I've been following what's going on with the Uyghurs in China, the Muslims there are being persecuted. What's happening with Christians there in Myanmar?
Christians make up about 7% of the country, and they're persecuted as they have been for a long time. First martyr here. And he was killed by Buddhist army soldiers. What else? They're sort of being persecuted, especially now that two armies have amassed. One is the coup's communist army, and the outer provinces, many of whom are Catholic, are belonging to the sort of a civilian rebellious group. They are fighting now between themselves. Right. So far, 1,000 Catholic villages have been destroyed.
Wow. 1,000 Catholic villages destroyed. Tell me a little bit about the kids that you work with. What are the dangers they face? I know there's a couple kids that you'd like to see come to the States to continue their education. We only have a few moments here, and our connection is bad, so maybe you could share that with everyone.
Well, I have 8 kids. Most of them are college kids. I only selected the ones who spoke English extremely well. I also have two high school kids, one 14 and one 16, and I'm also trying to get into a Catholic high school in the States. These are, you know, street kids. Some are not technically street kids because they live in some hovel, some yeah. shanty, some of which were demolished by soldiers or set ablaze. So I had to house them in my school with the families, obviously. And the ones who are not here, maybe because I was here and they want to be more mobile, was buying food at this point.
Yep.
Even money for rice is difficult. But that's yeah. the most important staple food. Well, if they had no meat or vegetables or anything.
Jack, it's really difficult to hear you. My deepest apologies. I know that we are talking, you know, to the other side of the planet, but we have a terrible connection. Let me just do this with you very quickly, if we could. Is there a website or is there information people can go to check out and get more information on those kids and what's happening?
I'm afraid that I can't publish anything. Okay. However, the National Catholic Register does list some Burmese articles that you can access and learn more about us.
Okay. Well, we'll check that out. I'll have my producer, Tom, who I know you know, maybe get us some links and we can put them up so people can see what's happening in Myanmar. I know there's been several stories. We'll try to get people connected. My apologies, Jack. I know you and I have been trying to connect for a while, but the connection here has been really rough. But I'm grateful for your time. Hang in there, okay? And be assured of our prayers and keep up your very important work, okay?
Thank you. Please let everyone know that we do desperately need to get these 8 children out, or 10 from the 2 high schools. Any Catholic high school that can offer homestays and education would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, so there's 8 kids that need to get out for their safety. There's a school or somebody who can help. Again, I guess the best thing to do is maybe contact us here, and then we'll connect them to you, Jack, which would be great. So if you feel moved to do that, let us know, and Jake will pass that information along. That's Jack Snow. Again, as I was saying, it's a pseudonym for him. He's actually joining us from Myanmar right now, and it's a situation where civilians are fleeing the country, Christians are being persecuted, 1,000 villages destroyed, and he's trying now to help to get several children out of harm's way. And he's an American who's living and working in Rangoon, also known as Yangon. I got to take a short pause. Stay with me when we come back. The Holy Father made big news today. Let me fill you in on what he said. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app.
Well, check this story out. My apologies for that last conversation. I know it was probably hard for you to hear. It was kind of hard for me. But this is a big story. This morning, my phone started buzzing, right? I'm barely out of bed, and I can't tell you how many different people, very passionate, ended up sending me a story about the new motu proprio, about the extraordinary form. Now, this, I'll decode that, and there's a lot of people who may not know what that meant, right? Let me back up here for you. I'm going to lay this out. Father Robert Gall is going to be stopping by. And I'll tell you a quick story here. For the last, I guess, few months, it's been rumored that Pope Francis was preparing some kind of document, a document that would place restrictions on the celebration of the Mass, according to the Missal of 1962. So that buzz was floating around. I'm thinking, well, is it true? Isn't it true? If you're not familiar with that Mass, it's known today as the Latin Mass. I know a lot of people love it. There's a real majesty to it. There's Latin. I mean, it's a gorgeous celebration, and I know many people enjoy to worship that way. The Latin Mass is also known as the extraordinary form, right? A title that Pope Benedict XVI gave it back in 2007. And this form of the Mass, it's been, I don't know, it's made a major comeback And maybe it's my personal worldview. I don't know. Maybe it's the people that speak to me about it. I mean, Jake was telling me, he says, especially for young people, they really love the extraordinary form, you know? So it's not like just in recent years, but it's made this comeback after being banned starting in 1970. So Pope St. John Paul, he allowed for it, and he used it actually under some conditions not too long after the Society of St. Pius X went into schism back in the 80s. But then Pope Benedict, he really opened up its use, you know, and that was, I think, 2007, and he allowed priests to celebrate it, and that change of the law made a huge difference in the number of priests who started celebrating it and the number of people who started to go to those masses. You might be one of those. You might be seeing that right now. But according to Pope Francis, the allowance of these masses, it wasn't going the way that his predecessor envisioned it, right? So this morning, the church received some news. The Vatican released a whole new set of laws that severely restrict its use. And in that document, Pope Francis said that John Paul's and Benedict's actions, which were intended to, and I want to quote them here, quote, recover the unity of an ecclesial body with diverse liturgical sensibilities was exploited to widen the gaps, reinforce the divergences, and encourage disagreements that injure the church, block her path, and expose her to the peril of division. So let me just stop on that one point right there, okay? I know a lot of people are upset today, and we'll talk about it. You can join us here. I'd be more than glad to dive into this. Pope Francis said that John Paul and Benedict's actions were intended to recover unity, right? But what we're seeing right now, he writes, is the gaps widened. There's disagreements. There's, the peril of division. This document really is about unity, ultimately, from the vantage point of Pope Francis. This is about unity. So now the bishop is the one who's going to decide where the Mass is celebrated and by whom. And, where it can't be celebrated, too. So we'll unpack this for you. There are bishops who are to appoint a priest who is, as delegate of the bishops, entrusted with these celebrations and with the pastoral care of the groups of the faithful. My guest today, to help us better understand this, I know this can kind of be inside baseball, can be kind of hard to understand. You might not even know that there was an extraordinary form of the Mass, but just to help you better understand what it's about and ultimately, what's driving this, I've invited Father Robert Gall, who's an associate professor of ethics at the Pontifical University of the Holy Cross in Rome, and he joins us this evening from Rome. Father, thank you for your time. I'm delighted to have you here today.
Thank you, Drew. It's great to be with you, and actually, I'm much closer than normal. I'm in Texas right now. Of course, Rome is my base, but I've just recently arrived in Texas.
Well, good. I don't have to worry about my connection, and I can say good afternoon then rather than good evening, right? Instead of Buona Sera, exactly. Hey, how are you, Father? Good to have you with me. It is good. So let's talk about this. I want to try to unpack it and speak in a language that people understand. We're using, words like multo proprio, extraordinary form. I mean, there's a lot of people who have no clue what this is all about. So why is it relevant, first of all? And tell me what the Holy Father did. And because there are segments of the church that are pretty upset about this. So what's Pope Francis trying to do? Maybe give us a 101 on this whole story.
Well, from a really broad perspective, and without getting into any of the inside baseball whatsoever, I think we can see this also in light of the current effort from the U.S. bishops to help all the church in the United States, including even the bishops themselves. Archbishop Jose Gomez, who's the president of the Bishops' Conference, has asked us to pray, especially for the bishops, too, regarding the Holy Eucharist, so we might rediscover the Holy Eucharist, and really, therefore, the holiness of the celebration of Mass, and how, of course, we know that it is at once the sacrifice of Calvary, it's the Last Supper, yeah. It's the resurrection of Jesus. And it's also, as the Last Supper, it's a banquet, and it's a community banquet of the entire church, including the saints in heaven. Every time we go to Mass, all of that is taking place. And sometimes, unfortunately, those who participate in Mass only see a piece of that component. And this, I think, is a way also of understanding why Pope Francis is concerned about division that has slipped into the church due to how Benedict's opening of the use of the what's called the extraordinary form to more people has led to some greater division, at least in some places. And Pope Francis recently canvassed the Universal Church around the globe. This was done in 2020 and got a response from the bishops from around the world regarding how this is applied in their dioceses. And the response for the Pope was worrisome for him because he makes this reference to the first letter of St. Paul to Corinthians. Are you with Paul or are you with Apollo? Are you with Cephas or are you with Christ? And so, of course, Pope Francis, as the Bishop of Rome, who is the successor of St. Peter, and therefore he's the principle of unity, the symbol of unity. Where Peter is, there the church is, for the universal church, is really trying to put things back together. And in doing that, I wouldn't see this document as a rupture. It is not a rupture with the past. It is in continuity, but it is a pretty strong, let's say, correction of the trajectory that had been taking place since 2007 with those loosening up of the application, the opening of the use of the extraordinary form with Pope Benedict with what's called Summorum Pontifico.
My guest today, Father Robert Gall, if you want to join us, the number here is 888-914-9149. Father, let's take a call or two as we get into this conversation. Matt is listening in the beautiful state of Maine. Matt, hi, you're on the air with Father Gall.
Hi, Father, and hi, Drew. I really appreciate all the work you guys are doing for the church right now.
Thank you.
Yes, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I just wanted to respond with a quick comment. I'm just absolutely just heartbroken. I really don't know what else to say, just because I discovered the Latin Mass in my sophomore year of high school, and I've loved it ever since. I even pursued, looked into joining the fraternity of St. Peter and all. And hopefully that'll be something down the road for me. But I love it. And to see how it's kind of being suppressed right now, it's just absolutely heartbreaking. I have no other words to describe it, really. And basically, since early this morning when I found out about it and my friends found out about it, it's been a nonstop conversation between at least 10, 12, 15 of my friends and I back and forth all day about, you know, what does this mean for us as Catholics? You know, yeah. I'm heartbroken.
Well, Matt, thanks for calling in. Father, I'll let you respond to him. He's not alone. I'm sure there's a lot of people who are shocked today and really enjoy the celebration of the Latin Mass.
Sure, Matt. So a lot will depend on the local bishop, but it seems to me that what Pope Francis desires with this is not something so shocking and terrible that you described, because I don't see him desiring in any way to shut down that which is already underway. So if you're happy with a Mass that celebrates with the extraordinary form that you have access to, the way I read this new law from Pope Francis is that he's encouraging that continue, so long as it is really, you know, entrusted to the under the supervision of the bishop, and that the priests who are celebrating it and the community really are in unity with the Catholic Church. And, you know, he specifies explicitly Vatican II. You know, I know, unfortunately, there are some people who participate, like, exclusively in the extraordinary form to the extent that they deny the, not just the legitimacy, but the validity of Mass that's celebrated in the ordinary form. So there are people who are claiming that what Pope Francis does when he celebrates Mass in St. Peter's isn't really the Mass. And, of course, he's trying to give a strong signal to them that both forms of the Mass, which is exactly what Benedict was saying, should be mutual and enriching, and they can support one another. And we should recognize that both of them are legitimate and valid ways of celebrating Holy Mass.
Hey, Matt, thank you for your call. I do appreciate it. Let me follow up on something he said. He was thinking about, I think, joining the Fraternal Society of St. Peter. There are some religious congregations, like the Fraternal Society of St. Peter, that exclusively celebrate particular form of Mass. What happens to them with this ruling? How does that shake out?
Right. So there's a very explicit thing regarding them that it's a shift of governance that they'll. And I see it as a way of really mainstreaming, in some ways, these societies, fraternities, and of and other societies of apostolic life, such that they'll be placed no longer under this special commission, which is within the Congregation of Doctrine of the Faith, which is really a transitional period meant to bring those who had entered into schism back into full communion. Instead, they're now mainstreamed, and they'll be under the governance of the Congregation for Consecrated Life, like other, just any other group, which is pursuing a special consecration and a special charism within the church. So hopefully, the way I see this is that now the Fraternity of St. Peter is really mainstreamed and affirmed by Pope Francis. So, I pray that Matt can move ahead with his, his piety and his love for the Mass and potentially his vocation as he described.
So unity really is the intention of the Holy Father, right? To bridge a widening gap where there can be division. Unity is kind of the heart of this. The authority goes to the bishop now. The local ordinary can decide, right, whether he wants to have this Mass celebrated in his diocese and by whom. Since this is now up to the local bishop, what happens if he decides that he's not going to allow it at all? No Mass in that parish at all, or in that diocese at all, right? No Latin Mass.
Right, right. First of all, regarding unity, and there's a lot of really interesting discussion of unity because there's a lot of very deep theological consideration regarding unity. It's a really important topic because we ought not to think that unity indicates homogeneity, as though we were all bland, like a smoothie that everybody's put in and whipped up and that everybody has to be the same. That's not the idea at all of unity. St. Basil, way back in, I think, the 5th century, wrote about this in a beautiful way, about how the Holy Spirit transmits life and grace to all of the plants and all the things in nature, just the way rain fall causes the flowers to bloom of all the different species and colors and producing the fruit and so forth. And that the church is in a similar way that we can, and we do celebrate Mass in so many different languages. People, of course, around the world with different nations and ethnicities and languages. And yet we need to be really united with the same faith, the same baptism, the same love, and the same Lord of Jesus Christ. But then, so this, regarding really your question, Drew, about the bishop, this new law by Pope Francis certainly hands great responsibility over to the bishop. Whereas instead, under Benedict, it was an extraordinary thing that he was opening up this path directly within a diocese, even potentially against the will of the bishop. And here again, what Pope Francis has done today is normalize things because the bishop represents Christ in the local church. And the Pope Francis is counting on his goodwill, his best intention, and that he will do so in a way that is really pastoral, meaning that he really cares about facilitating the sacraments and worship and piety of the faithful in his diocese. So hopefully with this this new authority that's really been given to the bishop, the local bishop, he will exercise it in a wise way. So instead of snuffing out people who are really in a legitimate way practicing a traditional form of piety, that he can facilitate it, but in a way that it's in unity with the whole flock.
All right, let's grab another call or two. We only have a couple of minutes left. Matt in Sacramento, California, you're on the air with Father Gall. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. Good afternoon, Father. Yeah, it's really disheartening because of some of the bishops that we have in the United States itself and around the world that are just completely against that form of the Mass, that when the people are in those dioceses, they're going to be affected. And when I go to a Novus Ordo Mass near Sacramento here, like where I live in Placerville, if I attend Mass here or go elsewhere when I can't get down to St. Stephen's in Sacramento, I get lost because it's like going to a Christian Protestant celebration because they take so much license with it and it becomes about entertaining us. The Mass gets lost in it. But when I go to the traditional rite that was passed down from the ages, you see it happen. My neighbor up here is a Messianic Jew, and he's seen the rite, and he's like, that's like the way they did it in the temple, everything to God. And it seems like since Vatican II, there's been so much, change that was not supposed to happen. Not the division. That's not it's not the traditional right that's that's causing the division. It's the people ourselves that are taking so much license with what they can and shouldn't do. And
Let me do this, Matt. Let me hold you for 1 second. I had to take a quick break. My guest today, Father Robert Gaul, when we come back, we'll respond to that. And I think it's important to unpack that. There is a certain majesty in that Latin Mass, a certain reverence. And there are some churches where he says it can look like a Protestant celebration. But let's talk about that. Let's try to bring some clarity. We'll talk about Vatican II, what was intended, what came from it. A lot of people like to throw stones at Vatican II. Well, you can join us, too. I only have a few moments, though. So if you want to get in, it's 888-914-9149. I'll try to grab a few more calls. We're taking a look at a big story breaking today coming out of the Vatican. The Holy Father on the new motu proprio about this extraordinary form of the Mass. And we'll fill you in on what that means and all the details right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Have you been away from the faith for a long time? You're welcome here. The Drew Mariani Show is live and here for you now on Relevant Radio.
Well, if you're just joining me, we will pray the chaplet in about 15 minutes. Talking about a story today where Pope Francis has issued a statement regarding the allowance of the masses. How am I going to rephrase this? I guess the best way to put it is, the Latin Mass has been celebrated for a long time. It's known as extraordinary form. And both St. John Paul II, Pope Benedict XVI, had allowed that to be celebrated. Pope Francis came out with a statement, a document. He said that, John Paul and Benedict, they intended to, I'm quoting him here, they intended to recover the unity of the ecclesial body with diverse liturgical sensibilities, but it was exploited to widen the gaps, reinforce divergences, and encourage disagreements that injure the church, block her path, and expose her to the peril of division. But he did give bishops, the authority to decide where the Mass can be celebrated and by whom. And bishops are to appoint a priest who's going to be the delegate of the bishop and is entrusted with the celebrations. I know there's a lot of confusion over it, a lot of people upset over this. And I've invited Father Robert Gaul to join me. He's an associate professor of ethics at the Pontifical University of Holy Cross in Rome. He joins us today from the great state of Texas. And we just had a call from Sacramento. Matt called in and says, hey, when I go to a Novus Ordo Mass, when I go to the Mass today, what we're seeing after the Second Vatican Council, he says it seems more like a Christian or Protestant type of Mass. And I think we could argue at that point, but there's some merit to it. There were times where, Father, there were clown masses and liturgical dancing and all sorts of stuff that goes on, and there are some liberties that take place. We are seeing an exodus out of the church. And I often think, do we need more majesty in the celebration of the Mass? We lost that. But to Matt's point, I'll let you respond because you heard his question, and he made a number of points.
You're right, absolutely. And it was also really beautiful how Matt mentioned that he has a friend who's a Messianic Jew, who's attracted to the traditional Mass, the extraordinary form, because he sees in it that majesty, that sacred character. And it reminds him of the sacrifices that were offered in the temple, which is really fascinating because of the, Pope Benedict referred to the mutual enrichment between the traditional Mass and the new Mass. But he also spoke often of how the New and the Old Testaments also illuminate one another. There's this kind of back and forth that is really a virtuous circle that we can, of course, we read the prophets and we see Jesus present in the prophetic texts and vice versa. We can also read the New Testament and in the light of the Old Testament and also gain insight that way. And there's something very, very comparable, analogous when we look at the older Mass, the traditional Mass or the extraordinary form, and then the Novus Ordo, the new Mass. And there too, we can see how they can illuminate one another. And this is especially true insofar as perhaps the experience of the more traditional Mass is one that is more vertical, that one has more of the sense of the sacred, that one is speaking to God, oftentimes speaking to God through the priest who has his back to the people generally. Whereas in the Novus Ordo, one has more of the sense of that it's the community that is celebrating and is speaking to God together. In fact, the active participation that Vatican II encourages us to bring to the Mass is where we go, each of us, to pray ourselves so that we understand the words that are being spoken and we make them our own, including the words the priest speaks at the altar in persona Christi. But Matt mentioned a really, really legitimate concern where he said that there are liturgical abuses unfortunately, that he experiences, that many people have noticed in the ordinary mass in English, the ordinary form. And this, in fact, in this, with this new law of Pope Francis, he refers to that. It mentions how problematic that is. And he condemns those abuses, whether they're in the ordinary form or the extraordinary form. So once again, I think it's important not to get too excited over this new law, but instead to see it as very much in continuity and meant to unite the church. So it's not as though Pope Francis is suddenly prohibiting all of these celebrations of the extraordinary form. Instead, he's putting them more directly under the vigilance of the local bishops so that they really be celebrated in such a way that they're not forming new cliques or groups that are somehow in contrast with the universal church in that local diocese. And he's also challenging, well, he's making it such that new groups or new younger priests who are ordained from now on will need special authorization in order to celebrate the extraordinary form, because the church wants to track how the extraordinary form is being used, again, in order to make sure that it's not being used as a wedge to split people among one another, but it's really being used to bring people together and to bring us especially together with God.
All right, let's take a few calls. Our number here, 888-914-9149. Mary Ann's listening in Round Rock, Texas. Mary Ann, good afternoon. You're on the air with Father Gall.
Thank you, Drew. Good afternoon, Father Gall. I had two comments, one regarding the unity aspect you mentioned, and one regarding the authority of the bishops that you mentioned. A little confusion in my part listening to this, but the first one in unity, I visited my son in Lithuania, and I've gone to the Latin Mass there and gone to the Latin Mass in America and gone to the Latin Mass in Rome, and they're all the same. And so to me, that definitely does depict unity, but you can go to a country in the vernacular and you don't understand what they're saying. You sort of know the order and the form, but in the Latin Mass, wherever you go around the world, it is the same. So that's one comment. It seems like that's more of unified than any of the individual vernacular, not to mention what the previous caller, Matthew, talked about. Different dioceses can perform vernaculars in different ways. And then the second comment was that you just mentioned it, newly ordained priests, if they want to celebrate the ordinary form of the Latin Mass, it's now out of the hands of their bishop. They have to now get approval from the Vatican, as I understand it. So that's taking authority away from our bishops. How do we think about that?
Well, yeah, these are great points, Marianne. Hi, thanks for asking these questions. First of all, regarding Latin as the instrument of unity, which, of course, has been really important throughout the church through centuries. Also, the fact that we can read, you know, like saints, and I'm thinking especially of St. Thomas Aquinas, who wrote the Adorate Devote, which, I mean, we can read, I mean, insofar as we know Latin, we can read what the great people in the church have written over many centuries. Of course, if we know Greek, too, we can go back to, like, St. Luke and read in the original language that he wrote the gospel in. But in any case, regarding Latin as a principle of unity, the new Mass is promulgated in Latin. And actually, you know, if people say that this is Latin Mass versus English Mass, that's a mistake, because the Latin Mass, which is the Novus Ordo, which is the language it was promulgated in, is totally unaffected by any of these regulations. So one can celebrate the Latin Mass. There is absolutely no restriction whatsoever for priests to celebrate the Latin Mass in Lithuania, in Bulgaria, and in the United States and in Canada. And in fact, I often celebrate Mass in Latin in the according to the new form. So the English is simply a translation of that. I think Pope Francis has encouraged us to use the vernacular in the readings, because he really wants people to be in tune with sacred scripture.
Well, Father, I only have about a moment or two left. I don't think I have time for more calls. Let me give you final thoughts, though. People want more information. Is there some resource they can look at to better understand what's happening here? And secondly, what do you want to leave us with?
Well, just to follow up too on the point of Marianne regarding the newly ordained priests, the way I read the document, it says that the bishop can authorize it, and then he should consult with the Holy See. And so I see this as really that the Holy See they're not the ones who are giving permission, but they want to be informed about what's happening around the world. And how we can stay informed, I'd really recommend to read the letter from Pope Francis. It's just a page and a half long, a couple of pages long, and it's really clear. The law is a little bit technical, but that too is fairly straightforward. So that's, for me, that would be the go-to source, is the Pope himself. And that way too, we can really, you know, pray for him. He's, you know, just got out of the hospital and he's asking for our prayers. He prayed at St. Mary Major's to the Blessed Virgin Mary, and he's grateful for all the prayers that we're offering for him. So this is an opportunity really for us all to, since he's asking for unity, to really practice that, especially for our prayers for him and his intentions.
All right. Well, Father, thank you for your time. Thanks for being here. Thanks for the clarity. I know there'll be a lot more dialogue about this in the days ahead, but I guess we'll leave it at that. Love to talk to you soon.
Thank you, Drew, and God bless all of you.
Thank you. God bless you. It's Father Robert Gaul, and I'm sure this story's not going away. I mean, you're going to hear much more about it in the days ahead, and I think Father gave, I think, a wonderful response and a lot of clarity to the issue. Pray for the Holy Father, too. Pray for him, and pray for our church. I mean, a lot of people like to throw stones and point fingers, but ultimately, it's our duty as faithful to pray. Let's ask the Holy Spirit to guide, to guard, and to illuminate. In fact, when we come back, we've got to take a break here. We will pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. So if you have a special intention or a need or need some extra prayer power, you can get in now. The number's 888-914-9149. Also, don't forget, you can still get Father Rocky's book on the rosary. Go to relevantradio.com/treasures. And get a wonderful work with reflections from St. Jose Maria Escriva, John Paul the Great, Father Rocky, and a lot of other great content as well. All right? That's yours. Limited time. Quantities are limited. Go and check it out right now. I'll be right back, and we'll pray.